Thank you. I'm Terry Eastland. I'm publisher of the Weekly Standard Magazine, and happy to be here with you today at this special forum discussing things around the table. It struck me that maybe we shouldn't really be doing law today. Maybe we should be previewing the debate tonight. I'm sure each of the panelists are prepared for that. Just kidding. But in any event, it's good that the court at least can interrupt our thoughts during this political season for long enough to preview and see what the court might be doing. The new term, as you know, begins on Monday, just days away. And our panel here today already has some interesting material. I believe 67 cases were decided last year by the court. As you know, that's a very low number. There were 43 cases that the court had taken until just recently. Someone up here no doubt knows the exact number after 2 days ago, what it is. And the court will undoubtedly take more cases as the term proceeds. Already has important voting rights and preemption cases, also some criminal law cases, as well as a case with some odd facts from the 11th Circuit that will be discussed. It deals with freedom of speech and the free exercise of religion. As well, there is news about a case that is not to be decided or reconsidered, I should say, in this term. That's Kennedy against Louisiana, the case in which the court held that state's child rape law to be unconstitutional. Very interesting case in its aftermath, as you know, this summer. There's other news as well. Two circuit judges, familiar to some of you, many of you perhaps in this room, Richard Posner out on the 7th and J. Harvey Wilkinson on the 4th, have vigorously taken issue with Justice Scalia's methodology in his Heller opinion, the one involving the D.C. gun law, where it was struck down. So we have some interesting side notes, if you will, as this term begins. What I'm going to do is introduce our panelists in the order in which they will be making their remarks. Each will go for 8 to 10 minutes. That's going to be a rule of law. That's a law of rules, you know. 8 to 10 minutes. Before I come back and ask a question of the entire panel, the question always worth asking in one of these presidential election years, and that concerns where the court might be headed, jurisprudentially speaking, and how the next president of the United States might affect the direction of the court, assuming perhaps some vacancies where there might be new appointees. And then we'll, if we have time, open it to the floor, I assume. Is that all right? Good. And there may be questions that you might wish to ask, and I would ask you please to direct those to a named individual rather than just in general, although more than one person might wish to provide an answer. Bill Otis has held a variety of legal jobs in government, and his last as a White House special counsel, I believe that was under the first George Bush, correct? He will consider the criminal cases, the most notable of which may be a Fourth Amendment case brought against the federal government. Bill, I think, was prepared to speak about Kennedy against Louisiana. If he has thoughts on the latest chapter in that story, they would be welcome. Allison Ho is a partner at Morgan, Lewis & Bockius, and will be looking at the preemption cases, including the Altria Group case, which Ted Olson will be arguing, I believe, Monday when the court opens. Virginia Seitz is a partner at Sidley & Austin. She oversees the firm's appellate and Supreme Court practice. She is well known for various of her involvements, including a brief that was submitted, an amicus brief in the Michigan affirmative action case several years ago that the court, I believe in the majority opinion in Gratz, is that correct, cited. That was a brief in behalf of a number of military officers and others involved in the military in that case. Virginia may have to leave a little early. That's because she has a teaching obligation, but she will certainly be with us, I think, for most of this presentation. Canon Shanmugam is a former assistant to the... Where is Canon? There he is. And I hope I got close to being correct. All right, good. Former assistant to the Solicitor General, that would be Paul Clement, right? And now is a partner, I guess soon to be, Monday, you start, at Williams & Connolly, is that correct? Canon has the voting rights cases, is that correct? One of which is a Section 2 vote dilution case. And batting fifth, I had to have a baseball, you know, illusion. After all, this is the time of the year we get to watch these games. Batting fifth, here's George Terwilliger. I guess we could also say you're cleaning up since there are only five players in the lineup here. White and Case, and, of course, a former deputy attorney general in the Justice Department. I think he served twice in the department. Qualifies him to speak, perhaps authoritatively, about a case being brought against the attorney general, that is to say, the first Bush attorney general, General Ashcroft, a case alleging personal liability on his part involving some issues arising from the prosecution of the war on terrorism. So with those brief, bare-bones introductions, Bill, we will start with you.
Thanks very much. I'd like to thank the Federal Society and Andrew Olson in particular, who was the main man in putting this together. I'm going to start first with something that 27 hours ago would have been a preview, but is now a little bit of a review, with some observations about what the denial of rehearing in Kennedy versus Louisiana really means that I think have been missed so far. The Eighth Amendment, it is said and was said in that case, draws its meaning from, quote, the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of maturing society. I think in light of the outcome there and the reasoning, it would be more accurate to say that the Eighth Amendment draws its meaning from devolving standards of responsibility that mark the decline of a society that mistakes moral fatigue for maturity. The retributive justification for the death penalty, which is the driving force when faced with a cruel and depraved crime, such as the one at issue in Kennedy versus Louisiana, is, in the court's view, at best problematic because, as the court said, and I'm quoting now, when the law punishes by death, it risks its own sudden descent into brutality, transgressing the constitutional commitment to decency and restraint, end quote. The catch that I think the press has missed is that that view applies to the death penalty as imposed for any offense. Thus, the court strangles the evolving standards it elsewhere purports to nourish and honor by ensuring that they all evolve in only one direction, that being towards abolition of the death penalty wholesale. Thus, the court says that respect for evolving standards, quote, on the way to full progress and mature judgment, means that resort to the death penalty must be reserved for the worst of crimes and limited in its instances of application, end quote. But, of course, it means more than that, as abolitionists will be quick to see. If in the name of growing decency, full progress, and mature judgment, we should limit the death penalty, why not cut to the chase and achieve this textually oblivious and besotted sainthood now and end the death penalty altogether? So the real news from yesterday's denial of rehearing is not that our increased understanding of the devastation brought about by a crime as violent and depraved as the one in that case will count for nothing, nor even that previously undiscussed acts of Congress will count for nothing, but that the doctrinal underpinnings for abolition of the death penalty for any crime have been laid now more clearly than ever. In its quick but stealthy march toward abolition, the court has often, though not so much actually in Kennedy versus Louisiana, more in Roper versus Simmons and Adkins, cited foreign law. It will therefore be interesting to see whether the views of other advanced Western countries will be brought to bear on the application of the exclusionary rule in the other case I'm going to talk about, that being Herring versus United States. It's actually a pretty interesting case presenting a question that was reserved in an earlier case from 1995. The question at issue in Herring is whether the exclusionary rule applies when a police officer makes an arrest and seizes drugs in the search incident to the arrest, after receiving information from a different police department that an outstanding warrant exists which information turns out to be incorrect because of a negligent error by the second police department in failing to remove the warrant from its files after the warrant was quashed or became stale. The question is likely to come down to, as it has in other exclusionary rule cases, whether the exclusionary rule is needed in this instance to deter careless mistakes of this kind. And two points should be made in thinking about that. The first is that that is an empirical question that courts are poorly positioned to answer. Whether deterrence is needed and the effects of deterrence is not something you can find out by going to a law book. You actually need a study to do that. No study has been undertaken, and the courts are not prepared to do it, nor should they be. The second point is that the reason we arrive at a question like that is that we're out on the limb we should have expected when the court makes up extra constitutional remedies, which is what the exclusionary rule is as applied to the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, by its terms, does not require exclusion of evidence, and for more than 100 years in this republic, there was no such thing. It is an invention by the courts. The argument about deterrence, because it's kind of this over here question that courts are poorly positioned to address, thus becomes largely a rhetorical and ideological one. The Department of Justice says, as you would expect, that the police are professional, that there are built-in incentives for accuracy in record keeping, that internal discipline and civil remedies will be sufficient to supply all the deterrence needed. The defendant and his amici respond with equally characteristic visceral distrust of the police. We are often told, you know, in this regard, that liberals welcome the future, but the liberal response in this Herring case is the ACLU's version of Groundhog Day, in which every morning you get up, it's still 1969. And all the supposed, although even then largely imagined, police abuses of the past still exist, just as they were said to have done for so long. This anachronistic thinking leads the liberals to suggest that the exclusionary rule should be extended to police conduct that happens by mistake, at the same time that in other contexts they believe, for example, that the death penalty, which applies to conduct which is undertaken intentionally, has no deterrent value. The conundrum of the exclusionary rule lies in its absolutist all-or-nothing approach. As it presently exists, it treats petty thieves the same as serial killers and rogue cops the same as honest policemen who miscalculate anything from the reliability of the neighboring police department's record-keeping glowingly refers. What should happen, that is that instead of having an absolutist exclusionary rule, if there is to be one at all as an extra constitutional remedy, the remedy should be a balancing one, one that balances the seriousness of the crime, the culpability of the police error, the importance of the evidence, and the effect on public confidence in the fair administration of justice by, on the one hand, admitting illegally obtained evidence versus releasing an obviously guilty and perhaps quite dangerous man to do it again. We'll see whether the court is prepared in this instance to apply foreign law.
I'm going to talk about cases in two areas of the law that at first may not appear to have much in common, preemption and immigration, although they do share sort of concerns about the importance of national uniformity. So I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the preemption cases and then a bit about a big immigration case before the court this term. First, preemption. Much has been written lately about the importance of the Supreme Court's business docket. And certainly the preemption cases are a particularly rich part of that docket, and this term are really front and center. And I have to say at the outset, it's quite humbling to be talking about the business cases with Tom Hungar in our audience, who has argued in certain, by any measure, some of the most significant business cases of the last several terms at least. Preemption is important to American businesses because they believe it helps ensure uniform national standards that promote efficiency, reduce barriers to interstate commerce, and prevent consumer confusion. Preemption is important to expert federal agencies because they believe preemption protects their comprehensive scientific risk-benefit assessments from being second-guessed by individual jurors in different states who would see before them only the people who've been hurt by a particular product and not others who have benefited from that product, who aren't before the court. And for that reason, among others, preemption has an important role to play in public health and safety generally, because I think that's particularly true in the medical device and drug context, because there you have a danger of overwarning of potential risks that can result in potentially beneficial treatments or medications being foregone. And you can also have a situation where serious risks get buried in a haystack of verbiage on labels. And this year the court is poised to hear two real blockbuster preemption cases. The first case, Altria versus Good, which involves the preemption of state law challenges to statements made in cigarette advertisements authorized by the Federal Trade Commission, and Wyeth versus Levine, which involves a preemption of state law challenges to prescription drug warnings approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. I'll say up front, in the interest of full disclosure, I assisted in drafting an amicus brief filed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in the Altria versus Good case on behalf of petitioner Altria and in support of federal preemption, to say that up front. Altria versus Good, as Terry mentioned, will be the very first case argued this term. It will be the 50th U.S. Supreme Court case argued by Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General and great friend of the society. In Altria, a group of smokers brought a class action against Philip Morris, the cigarette maker, under Maine's state consumer fraud statute, arguing that the use of descriptors such as light or lower tar and nicotine as used in the advertisements are misleading, even though the descriptors accurately reflect the results of FTC-mandated testing. Now, the plaintiff's theory of liability in Altria is that the cigarettes do not, the descriptors of the cigarettes do not accurately reflect the actual tar and nicotine delivery of light cigarettes because the FTC's testing method doesn't account for real-world conditions such as a smoker's alleged tendency to overcompensate for the lower tar and nicotine yield by, say, taking longer puffs, more puffs, or simply smoking more cigarettes. The federal district court in the case rejected plaintiff's theory of liability, found in favor of preemption here, and it did so on the basis of the Federal Cigarette Labeling and Advertising Act, which explicitly prohibits states from imposing any requirement or prohibition based on smoking and health with respect to the advertising or promotion of any cigarettes. The Court of Appeals for the First Circuit disagreed, however, ruling that state law claims are not preempted, no matter how intertwined with smoking and health they may be, so long as they are premised on a state law duty that imposes obligations beyond the context of smoking and health, and found that Maine's consumer fraud law was it did impose such duties. The second preemption case, Wyeth versus Levine, concerns an anti-nausea drug that Wyeth has marketed for over 50 years with FDA approval. And the drug could be administered in several ways, one of which is called the IV push method of administration. Over 40 years ago, Wyeth received a report of a patient who was afflicted with gangrene, resulting in the amputation of a limb as a result of arterial blood exposure to the drug when administered through IV push. So over the next several decades, the drug's label was changed with FDA approval specifically to warn of that risk on the label, and also to call attention to the benefits of other methods of administering the drug. In 2000, a patient, Diana Levine, was suffering from symptoms of migraine, and she was given two injections of the anti-nausea drug. The first injection proved ineffective, and so she was given a second injection by the IV push method of administration. And it was as a result of that second injection, she developed gangrene, ultimately resulted in the amputation of her forearm. After settling a malpractice claim against the clinic, Ms. Levine brought suit against Wyeth, arguing that the company should have warned against any use of the drug by IV push administration. The jury awarded Ms. Levine a $6 million judgment, and the Vermont Supreme Court upheld that judgment, rejecting Wyeth's argument that the state law claim was impliedly preempted under the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act because the plaintiff was challenging labeling that the FDA had approved after being informed of the relevant and specific risk involved in the case based on the expert agency's weighing of the risk and costs of allowing IV push administration along with the benefits and risk associated with requiring a different or additional warnings. Now, obviously, time doesn't permit sort of detailed analysis of a lot of the really complex and interesting issues raised in these two preemption cases. So I'll focus on sort of what I see as kind of the key takeaway from the cases, and that's that both of these preemption cases involve really important and potentially far-reaching questions about the proper relationship between federal regulation and state tort law. In Wyeth, for example, the preemption question essentially boils down to whether the FDA, having considered the precise risk at issue in that case, in approving that label, whether the FDA set a ceiling or whether, and that's what the Vermont Supreme Court found. In other words, it set a floor so that then state tort regulation can then come in on top of that, or whether, as Wyeth argues, the federal agency set both a floor and a ceiling that limits the action of the state tort system in that context. And I think the court's answer to that question could have great ramifications far beyond the specific context of the regulatory scheme at issue in Wyeth, and as important as regulation of prescription drugs is, and really extend to any case where you have a situation in which there's a possibility that individual jurors in different states will strike a different balance with respect to safety, with respect to the risk, reward, costs, and benefits of any particular one struck by expert federal agencies. In Altria, for example, a plaintiff's theory of liability that the FTC's federally mandated tests do not reflect real-world conditions could be extended to attack virtually any federal regime that relies on standards such as the federally authorized labeling of cookies as low fat because of the alleged tendency of consumers to eat more to compensate for the lower fat content. Kid you not, seriously. To automobile crash test ratings, which has been litigated under this theory, and even to wine labeling. So I think these cases, both of them raise really interesting questions that have to do with the relationship between state tort law and federal regulation that could potentially have an impact far beyond the particular industries and facts and circumstances and statutory regimes of these cases. Finally, just a brief word about the immigration case that's going to be heard this term. It's the case of Nguzi versus Mukasey. That case involves the so-called persecution bar, in which Congress has prohibited applicants for asylum in the United States from receiving asylum if they have assisted or participated in the persecution of others based on protected characteristics such as religion. And this case involves a prison guard who was conscripted to serve as a prison guard and stood by in a prison while the captives were brutally tortured and murdered. The courts of appeals have reached different conclusions about whether the persecution bar applies in situations such as this one where you have duress and coercion. So presumably the court granted review in the case to sort of provide a national uniform interpretation of the persecution bar and decide whether it's sort of a categorical bar in such cases or whether there are possible exceptions for duress or coercion.
Virginia Seitz, and I'm an old-time union lawyer, and my current major union client is the Baseball Players Association, and I definitely wish I were here to talk about my fantasy baseball case. but the court denied cert in that, so the labor and employment docket is considerably less sexy than it might otherwise have been. But it's mine, and so I love it. The most important trend, I think, in the area of labor and employment law in the Supreme Court is that with respect to the private sector workforce, there is a consistent Supreme Court focus on employment law and an absence of labor law issues. And this, I think, is largely due to the steady decline in union representation in the private sector. And this term might appear to have an exception in the first case I'm going to talk about, but as you'll see as I discuss it, that's not so. In fact, this first case is an illustration of the primacy of employment law. That case is 14 Penn Plaza versus Pyatt, and it presents the question whether a union can waive employees' rights to bring statutory discrimination claims in court by agreeing in a federal collective bargaining agreement to arbitrate such claims. The court had previously reserved this question in a case called Wright versus Longshoremen's Union, and it has struggled mightily to avoid deciding the question, which I think is going to be a difficult one. But unfortunately, in this case, the waiver is expressed, if any waiver is expressed. The collective bargaining agreement states that arbitration is the, quote, sole and exclusive remedy for all employment discrimination claims, including those. Then it goes on to list a number of federal anti-discrimination statutes. So it's really an inescapable, clear waiver. And the union is arbitrating a lot of claims in this case that are related to the subcontracting, which is the, you know, the core of the dispute. But it specifically withdrew the age discrimination claim that's at issue from the arbitral process. So, and the only thing that remains then is with the holding of the lower court was clear, and it is here. The Second Circuit held that any union waiver of employees' rights to litigate such claims is unenforceable, no matter how clear it is. So this tees up, you know, absolutely perfectly the question of whether or not unions have any power to waive individual employee rights to litigate employment discrimination claims. So this case involves a union, but in my judgment, it really reveals the primacy of employment law. These substantive statutory rights to protect individuals in the workplace are now seen as the primary mechanism for worker protection. The unions in this case support the argument that they can't waive these individual rights for the collective good, declining to claim that in light of their exclusive representation status, they could waive individual rights. This is truly remarkable to me, and now it just shows my age in the labor law bar, I think, but they should be arguing, I think, that they may do so as long as it's not arbitrary to waive individual rights that or discriminatory to waive individual rights in a particular case. This case, I think, thus presents in a little microcosm the consequences for law of declining union representation in the private sector. These individual rights and externally imposed statutory protections are what are seen as the primary employee protection device, and collective action and union activity is no longer at the forefront. And I think the court's docket reflects this. And, you know, it's very revealing, I think, in this one little case what the current status of the unionized American workplace is. The second case I'm going to talk about is Crawford versus Nashville. And this asks whether Title VII's anti-retaliation provision protects workers from adverse action for cooperating in an employer's internal sex discrimination investigation. In this case, an employee told investigators that a supervisor had behaved quite inappropriately in a variety of ways. The school district declined to discipline that supervisor and instead fired Crawford and all the others who had testified against this fellow. Crawford said that violates both the opposition clause of Title VII, which is the clause that forbids adverse action against employees who oppose discrimination, and it also offended the participation clause, which forbids employers to take adverse actions against those who participate in investigations under the statute. The Sixth Circuit in this case said, nope, the opposition clause only protects employees who protest discrimination by actively complaining to the employer or the government. And the participation clause only applies to investigations by the EEOC and not internal investigations. Well, the interesting thing about this case is the court has now taken this huge bolus of retaliation cases under a variety of federal employment statutes, including public sector and private sector employment statutes. In each instance now, the court has found, has treated retaliation in a very common sense way. As a practical matter, they see it as an adjunct or collateral form of discrimination if people are retaliated against for complaining about discrimination. And so I believe that this case is going to follow that trend. The government has come in on the side of the employee in this case, arguing, as it did last term in the retaliation cases, that retaliation is a form of discrimination. And retaliation, I think, will be conceived of as a kind of discriminatory conduct and actionable. And thus, the court is going to see and define retaliation broadly rather than formalistically, and not restrict it to, and not define retaliation as something that only happens at a particular point in time after an EEOC charge has been filed. But instead, we'll see the employer's action as retaliatory, even though it preceded or was related to his own internal investigation. As I say, I think this fits into the trend. Retaliation has proven, you know, I think it now constitutes roughly half at least of employment discrimination claims. It's seen as a very important element of anti-discrimination protection. This isn't going to buck that trend. I think the court's going to find here, too, that this form of is retaliation and it's actionable under Title VII. And the last case I want to talk about isn't an employment case. It's Fitzgerald versus Barnstable. It's a Title IX case, which, and everyone knows Title IX, the law requiring equal educational opportunities for male and female students. But it's an important, many, many Title IX cases are employment cases. In fact, almost all the Title IX cases I've handled have been employment cases where coaches and teachers are fired for protesting, for example, discriminatory treatment for girls in athletics. The reason I think this case is important is because the issue presented has both specific and general importance. The issue is, does Title IX provide the exclusive remedy for sex discrimination claims in this educational setting, or can victims sue for denial of equal protection under Section 1983 also? So they, can they elect which one way to pursue? This is particularly interesting, I think, because the question of a specific federal statute's displacement of another federal statute involves an implied cause of action under Title IX. And so you're asking, you know, in essence, whether the more specific statute, whether you first you have to infer the cause of action under Title IX, and then you have to infer that Congress intended in the inferred cause of action to displace this other express cause of action under Section 1983. So it's a very specifically interesting context for this new and growing trend of analyzing two federal statutes and determining whether a particular remedy in one displaces a more general cause of action in another. This setting, I posed to, isn't the perfect setting for those who'd like to see a lot of displacement going on, because I think when you have an inferred cause of action, it becomes very difficult to add another inference on top of that. Be that as it may, this is coming up repeatedly, the IDEA. There's a split in the circuits on the question whether the IDEA displaces Section 1983 causes of action. So there's going to be generally an important displacement analysis. And second, as I look back historically over the general judicial treatment of the interaction of federal statutes, whatever happened to harmonization? I mean, this harmonization of federal statutes making both work simultaneously seems to have gone out the window with a very growing trend, and you saw it in Exxon Valdez last term, of displacement by one particular federal statute of another. So I think this case is also going to tell us a lot about that trend.
Great. Thanks, Virginia. I think I'm probably unique on this panel in that I'm the only person on the panel who is currently unemployed. I left the Justice Department back in August, and as Terry mentioned, I'm going to be starting at Williams & Connolly on Monday. And as a result, I've really been spending the last few weeks focusing more on changing diapers than I have on the Supreme Court. But it's a great pleasure to be here today with such distinguished co-panelists to be talking about the Supreme Court and its upcoming docket. We promised you a panel discussion today, and in the interest of getting to the discussion part of this sooner rather than later, I promise to be very brief. As Terry mentioned, I'm going to talk about the voting rights cases, and I'm also going to talk about a couple of the First Amendment cases that are on the court's docket. But I would like to start with the voting rights cases, and the first case I'd like to discuss is a case that I actually think has the potential to be the real sleeper on the court's docket this term, and that's a case called Bartlett versus Strickland, which is scheduled for oral argument in October. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should note that I did work on that case while I was still at the Justice Department. Bartlett involves an issue that is somewhat arcane, but which is of potentially massive practical significance. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 prohibits any voting practice that results in the denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race. And the Supreme Court has long construed Section 2 to prohibit vote dilution, that is, a voting practice that minimizes the voting strength of any particular racial or ethnic group. And in the seminal case on vote dilution, a 1986 case called Thornburg versus Jingles, the court, in an opinion written by Justice Brennan, concluded that in order to state a valid vote dilution claim, a plaintiff must show that an allegedly disadvantaged racial group is sufficiently large that it could constitute a majority in a proposed district. Or, to put it another way, that a so-called majority-minority district could have been, but was not in fact, drawn. The question presented in the Bartlett case is one that the court actually left open in Jingles and again in a number of subsequent cases over the intervening 25 years, and that is whether a plaintiff can proceed with a vote dilution claim simply by showing that while a minority group was not sufficiently large that it could constitute a majority in a proposed district, it was sufficiently large that it could elect its preferred representative with the help of crossover votes from members of other racial groups. Now, why is this seemingly obscure issue of such great practical importance? Well, I think the answer lies in the way that redistricting has developed in recent political cycles. Of course, the reality in American politics is that particular racial groups often tend to favor one political party over another. Perhaps most notably in recent times, African-American voters have tended to favor the Democratic Party, and indeed, at least in presidential elections, to do so by overwhelming margins. In redistricting, in the wake of the 2000 census, the most recent wave of redistricting, the Democratic Party in some areas actually deliberately proposed districts, particularly where the incumbent was an African-American Democratic representative, that had smaller numbers of African-American voters. Now, why would they do this? Well, I think that the Democratic Party projected that in many of these districts, with the help of crossover votes from white Democrats, the Democratic candidate would still be elected, and that would enable the Democratic Party to maximize its power in other adjoining districts. Well, perhaps not surprisingly, the Republican Party in the last redistricting cycle resisted such crossover districts on the theory that such districts would allow Democrats to maximize their voting strength overall. And so at the risk of oversimplification, the question presented in the Bartlett case is really whether such crossover districts are required by the Voting Rights Act on the theory that the failure to draw such districts would be impermissibly dilutive of minority voting strength. And whatever the ultimate outcome of Bartlett, and I think it is fair to say that it promises to be close, it's going to have a considerable impact on the way that legislatures engage in redistricting, both in the rapidly approaching 2010 census cycle and beyond. The other voting rights case that I'd like to mention is one that actually isn't even on the court's plenary docket yet, and that's a case called Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District versus Mukasey. The question presented in that case involves nothing less than the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which is one of the Voting Rights Act's central and most controversial provisions. Section 5 requires covered jurisdictions, mostly jurisdictions in the South, to seek pre-approval either from the Attorney General or from a federal district court whenever they want to make changes in their voting practices. It was initially enacted in 1965 as a temporary measure and was subsequently upheld as a valid exercise of Congress's remedial powers under the 14th Amendment in a significant case called South Carolina versus Katzenbach. But in the ensuing years, Section 5 has repeatedly been reenacted and in some respects even broadened. Most recently in 2006, when Congress reenacted Section 5 for another 25 years. In a nutshell, the question presented in the Northwest Austin case is whether there was a sufficient record of racial discrimination before Congress when it reenacted Section 5 in 2006 to continue to sustain Section 5 as a valid exercise of Congress's 14th Amendment powers. Now, although the Justice Department has come under sustained criticism from civil rights groups in recent years, it has vigorously defended the constitutionality of Section 5 as reauthorized, and a three-judge district court here in Washington recently and unanimously upheld the constitutionality of the statute. The challengers in the Northwest Austin case recently filed a brief in the Supreme Court seeking plenary review, and the court will consider that request later on in the fall. And if the court does grant review, it will probably hear the case in the spring. And that means that it will hear the case after a new president is inaugurated, though it seems unlikely that any change in administration will lead to any change in the Justice Department's litigating position in this vitally important case. Well, I promised I'd say just a few words about the court's First Amendment cases before I hand over to George, so let me do that very quickly. If Bartlett is potentially the biggest sleeper on the court's docket this term, I think one could plausibly argue that the most overhyped case is FCC versus Fox television stations. That case involves the validity of the FCC's determination that the over-the-air broadcast of so-called fleeting expletives violates long-standing statutory prohibitions on the broadcast of indecent material. After the FCC made that determination, it found that two of our largest broadcasters, NBC and Fox, had violated federal law when they broadcast live award shows in which various actors and singers used expletives in the course of presenting or accepting awards. I'm not sure what it is about award shows that brings out fleeting expletives, but there you go. Those are the facts of the case. Now, when the Fox case is argued in November, it will inevitably attract a considerable press attention, not least because it will probably be the first time and hopefully the last time that Paris Hilton's name is uttered in the Supreme Court. And I suspect that the bookmakers will shortly be taking bets on how often Virginia's partner, Carter Phillips, will use the F word during his oral argument representing Fox. But In my view, I think there's a significant likelihood that this case is going to turn out to be something of a damp squib. And that's because I think that the case is likely to turn not on the question of whether it is constitutional under the First Amendment to regulate the broadcast of fleeting expletives, but rather on the more prosaic question whether the FCC provided a sufficient explanation under the Administrative Procedure Act to justify its determination that the broadcast of fleeting expletives violates federal law, a determination that conceivably constituted a change in the FCC's position. And if the court decides the case based only on the latter question, its opinion is likely to be of interest only to students of administrative law and not to fans of Paris Hilton, assuming that the two groups are mutually exclusive. I would like to say just a word about one final case, and that's a case called Pleasant Grove City versus Sumum, which will also be argued in November. It's a very interesting case, and the facts of the case are as follows. It involves a relatively small and newly minted religious organization that sought permission to place a monument in a public park that also contained various other privately donated monuments. The city that administered the park denied the request, and it offered two grounds for doing so. First, that the monument did not relate to the city's history, and second, that the organization did not have longstanding ties to the community. Well, the organization turned around and brought suit, claiming, among other things, that the denial of its request violated the free speech clause of the First Amendment. They had claims under the religion clauses as well, but those are not at issue as the case comes to the Supreme Court. Well, the Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit agreed with the religious organization, and it concluded that the denial of the placement of the monument constituted an impermissible content-based regulation of speech in a traditional public forum. Before the Supreme Court, the city, supported by the federal government, has argued that the denial did not implicate the First Amendment for two reasons. Again, first, because the selection of monuments for the park constituted government speech and not private speech, and in the alternative, that even if it somehow constituted private speech, that there was no First Amendment violation because the park constituted, at most, a non-public forum. If I had to guess, I would predict that the city will likely prevail, but I think it would take a braver man than me to predict exactly how the court will decide this very interesting First Amendment case. So with that, I think I'll hand over to George, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about those cases when we get to the discussion.
Thank you. Speaking of fleeting expletives, the first case that I want to discuss could well engender a few, at least mentally expressed, if not not verbally. Winter versus Natural Resources Defense Council is a case that's been in the press, and I think if one were cynical, you could characterize the issue as whether Navy sailors and the U.S. Navy itself, as well as innocent merchant mariners, can successfully compete for protection under the law, at least in the Ninth Circuit, with other allegedly endangered species. This is the case that that pits the Navy and indeed the president against a district court in California over the Navy's use of a very modern and advanced type of sonar, which apparently upsets the whales greatly. Now, in fairness, I must say that when you delve into the facts of this a little bit, which I did not do prior to preparing for this exercise, the evidence is fairly strong that the whales are really upset about this and often beach themselves and do other things that that are clearly harmful. The sonar, however, is a type of sonar that the Navy has developed to assist them in detecting the presence of a new, very advanced generation of quiet diesel-electric submarines, a type of submarine that has been deployed in significant numbers by, among other military forces in the world, the Chinese. And the training at issue is specifically for sailors who are to be deployed to the Western Pacific for that purpose. it once again is a case that seems to pit the Bush administration and its prerogatives against the prerogatives of the court. And in fact, in this case, the issue is squarely joined because the president exercised some authority that he has under the Coastal Zone Management Act to, in essence, override the injunctive relief against the training, or at least limiting the training that the district court had had provided. And there's really a number of interesting aspects to this, but perhaps the most interesting is the exercise that the Ninth Circuit went through in reviewing the balance of hardships between the two parties. And let me, if I may, I won't do this with the other cases, but just share with you one of the more interesting parts of this. The Navy maintains, the Ninth Circuit writes, and the district court did not contest that its ability to train and certify its West Coast strike groups for combat development is critical. The Navy argues that its ability to engage in these activities is severely degraded under the injunction by having to shut down the use of sonar when a marine mammal is detected within 2,200 yards of a sonar-emitting source. And under the injunction, there's observers out there to make sure they do that. And the requirement to power down its sonar use by 75% when significant surface ducting conditions are present. The president said, look, we're just going to go ahead and do this anyway, the district court notwithstanding. And the district court ruled and the Ninth Circuit upheld that although the imposition of these mitigation measures will require the Navy to alter and adapt the way it conducts anti-submarine warfare training, it does not preclude the Navy from effectively training. So here we have a district court judge deciding for the admirals how effective training will be conducted. It's going to be a very interesting decision. There's much administrative law, of course, poured in through all of this, but at the end of the day, this really is part of the power struggle between the executive and the courts. There's two cases I want to talk about together that will be a special interest to anyone foolish enough to be considering a public service career at, say, the Justice Department, where Terry and I and others at this table and in this room used to work. One is Ashcroft versus, and if somebody can help me with the proper pronunciation of this Pakistani name, Iqbal, I believe. And the other is Vandekamp versus Goldstein. Both of these are in essence, immunity cases. In the former, a Pakistani citizen was swept up in the aggressive FBI law enforcement actions that took place immediately after September 11th. As you may recall, I think in the words of then Criminal Division Assistant Attorney General Mike Chertoff, the government made aggressive use of every legal tool at its disposal to try and ensure the prevention of further attacks in the United States. He was charged with conspiracy to defraud the United States and fraud in relation to identification documents, was incarcerated without bail, eventually pled guilty, served a sentence, and was deported to Pakistan. He has sued on the basis of the conditions of his confinement, which I think by any objective criteria were harsh. He was sent to a supermax facility, kept in isolation, and other things of that sort. But what the case presents is the question of whether or not the Attorney General and the Director of the FBI, among other supervisory officials, can be sued and not enjoy immunity where there's no showing of their personal involvement in the activities in question, or is their promulgation and direction of policies which allegedly led to these actions that result in his conditions of confinement sufficient personal involvement to lead to their potential liability in this Bivens action. The Second Circuit said that he sufficiently pleaded a plausible set of facts by which supervisory officials were personally involved. And This is part of a series of cases which really address the limits of these Bivens. You know, Bivens is basically a suit for a constitutional tort. The Second Circuit, against that trend, has broadened the coverage of Bivens actions by extending it to these supervisory officials in a circumstance where, at least arguably, there is not sufficient personal involvement by the officials in question. So if you're contemplating a career at the Justice Department and wish to serve as a supervisory official, you might want to pay attention to this case. The Vandekamp case is another interesting immunity case that arises in California. As many of you know, prosecutors have a duty prior to a criminal trial to disclose certain kinds of information that is generally exculpatory in nature to the defendant and his or her counsel. This is a case, again, involving this supervisory notion where the DA himself is sued for failure to implement sufficient training and operations to ensure that the deputy DAs who are actually doing this work meet the responsibility to make these disclosures. This case also presents a yet another iteration of the ongoing attempts by the court to slice and dice the difference between absolute and qualified immunity when applied in the setting of the actions of prosecutors. And in essence, prosecutorial immunity derives completely from judicial immunity. So if a prosecutor, absolute prosecutorial immunity, if a prosecutor is performing an act in aid of the judicial role, then a prosecutor will have absolute immunity. If he's performing some other act, albeit within the scope of his or her duties, but not in aid of a judicial role, such as giving the police advice about how to conduct an investigation as opposed to how to gather facts to obtain probable cause for a search warrant, they'll only have qualified immunity. This, again, will be an interesting case, and prosecutors no doubt will pay close attention to this. It does have the potential, if it goes the wrong way, to undo a lot of the immunity that has been afforded prosecutors to date, which as a defense attorney today I have mixed feelings about, but that's another issue. I want to bring one last case to your attention that is not yet on the docket. I believe it was in conference Monday, and no action was taken on the cert petition, but I think this is a very important case, particularly to the business community. This is Kay versus the United States, which is a decision coming out of the Fifth Circuit, interpreting an aspect of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. For those of you who don't know, the Justice Department has been on a tear in enforcing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act over the past few years. I run a global white-collar practice group at an international law firm, and I would say half of the work we do is related to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in some way. The act prohibits, in essence, U.S. companies and U.S. persons, including their foreign subsidiaries, from paying bribes in order to obtain or retain business. In this case, the Haitian subsidiary of a U.S. company paid bribes to Haitian officials to obtain favorable tax treatments or rulings in its business in Haiti. And the question is, in interpreting whether this is a violation of the act, is it sufficient to obtain or retain business to meet that requirement, that element of the offense, if, in fact, you're paying bribes to get favorable tax treatment? The Fifth Circuit said yes. It's argued strenuously on the other side that that is outside the scope of business. In this case, if the court takes it, will probably turn, at least in part, on the interpretation of what the term business in the statute means, which brings me to one trend that I think is worth mentioning. Justice Scalia, with characteristic clarity in a money laundering case last year, said, "We interpret ambiguous criminal statutes in favor of defendants, not prosecutors." That was in the context of applying the rule of lenity, and is probably the most cogent statement of what the rule of lenity actually is that I've seen. The question that brings that to bear in the K case is whether the court ought to resort to legislative history to interpret what business means, and whether that's necessary, or whether business is a plain enough term on its own that it can be interpreted expressly under the statute and doesn't exclude those things that are corollary or collateral to business, such as tax treatments. I think if the court does take that case, I would not be surprised, at least to see Justice Scalia repeat, we interpret criminal statutes in favor of defendants, not prosecutors, where there is some ambiguity. There is some ambiguity about this term business, and resolve that against the Justice Department. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, George, and thank you, all members of the panel. Cannon reminds me that the question I posed earlier maybe needs to be revised a bit, because not only can a new administration, a new president, affect the direction of the court, it can affect the enforcement at the Justice Department, and in particular can affect maybe the filings in the Supreme Court. And so to the panel, and I think we'll start with you, Virginia, but I want to make sure we get you in before you have to leave. Let me just throw this out, however you wish to answer. Some of you may decline to answer it. You don't want to be on the record, perhaps, but in my business, you're supposed to be all the time saying these things. So how might a new president, whichever one you want to pick or both, have an impact upon the future direction, maybe jurisprudentially, of the Supreme Court? And perhaps also more narrowly, how might a new president, I mean, do you see any Bob Jones cases out there, maybe to cut to the chase here? Are there any cases in which you see perhaps the Justice Department's, the SG's office, taking a different position?
I'm fundamentally of a very optimistic bent about law and the potential of the justice system. And so what I would say about a new president is that I think there's a trend, a really noticeable trend, with justices like Roberts and Alito to the appointment to the Supreme Court of extremely high-quality justices, and I would expect that that would bode well for someone like Merrick Garland, so there'd be an articulate voice on the other side, perhaps, of some of these issues. But I expect a new president to recognize that there's a need for people who can stand up to, articulate, and represent, you know, effectively their position within a court that's so intellectually powerful, and to select justices of a similar quality. That may be over-optimistic, but that's what I hope for, and that's what I would expect. And I would expect that someone watching the performance of the most recent additions to the Supreme Court would realize the value of that approach. So I am hopeful that we'll continue to see, you know, high-quality folks of experience, judgment, and legal skill appointed to the court, and I fully expect that to happen.
Well, you know, it's funny. The first presidential election I ever voted in was in 1992 when I was in college, and I realize in saying that that half the people in the room will think, boy, he's really young, and half the people will think, gee, he's really old. But so this will be, I guess, the fifth presidential election I voted in, and in every single one of those elections, there's been somebody out there saying, gosh, this is going to be the most important election ever for the Supreme Court. And, you know, here we are in 2008, and I think somebody could actually plausibly make the argument that the Supreme Court is more or less in the same place that it was back then in 1992 when I cast my vote for the first time. Obviously, there have been differences around the edges, and if you took any particular area of the law, you could say that that was true. But, you know, ultimately, we have a Supreme Court that is in relative equipoise and has been true for most of the last 16 years. You can point to a particular member of the court and say that person is the swing justice. So it's easy to say that the next presidential election could make a very profound difference in the direction of the court. I think from the point of view of somebody who's been, you know, a house husband for the last few weeks and just sort of watching a lot of CNN and Fox and reading a lot of newspapers and magazines, it seems to me that There's been sort of more of an outcry about the potential future direction of the court from the left than from the right in this election cycle. A lot of it tends to focus on Justice Stevens because Justice Stevens is 88 years old, and so people say, well, if Justice Stevens were replaced by a more conservative nominee, that would tilt the direction of the court. And I think that that's true, but for the small fact that having appeared before Justice Stevens on a number of occasions over the last few years, I can attest to the fact that he shows absolutely no signs of slowing down. He seems to be in delightful health, and so I think that predictions of his demise are likely greatly exaggerated. But, you know, one thing I will say, one thing I did just sort of idly the other day in preparing for this panel was I sat down and said, well, let's assume we have a president who lasts for two terms, as has been seemingly the trend lately, you know, how old would the current members of the court be in 2017 on that president's last day in office? And it's kind of interesting. I'll run down the list. Justice Stevens would be 96, Justice Ginsburg, 83, Justices Scalia and Kennedy, 80, Justice Breyer, 78, Justice Souter, 77, Justice Thomas, 68, Justice Alito, 66, and the Chief Justice, 61. So you would have, you know, six members of the court who would be over 75, and, you know, in any other profession, that would be well past retirement age. One can never predict what would cause a Supreme Court justice to decide to leave the bench, but I think it's fair to say that there is the potential with this election for members of the court from sort of all points on the jurisprudential spectrum to leave in the next 4 or 8 years. And so I think that an inevitable consequence is that one can say with some degree of confidence that there is the possibility that the Supreme Court will really sort of decisively change in the next administration, regardless of who wins the election.
One can't help but listen to that list and observe that justices seem to live a long time. maybe it's the gym. I do think that there will be potentially profound differences on the Supreme Court depending on the outcome of the election, and probably more so if Senator Obama is elected, because the court will start trending more to the left than where it is today. That said, however, you know, my own view is that smart is as important as ideology, if I can echo Virginia a little bit, given the complexity of a lot of the cases that reach the court. The unfortunate part is that nominations and now confirmations to the court have taken on the same level of or lack of level of political importance that many other decisions that are made through the machinery of government have taken on. That is, they are divided, they are ideological, they are often looked at purely in terms of political advantage as opposed to substantively what's good for the country. And unfortunately, this also reflects, because politicians do tend to reflect their constituencies, the divisions that exist politically, philosophically, and ideologically in our society. I don't see that changing anytime soon, absent some catastrophic events which tend to drive us all a little closer together and maybe more towards the middle.
I'll be very, very brief in attempt to get to questions from y'all. In terms of the business cases and the preemption cases in particular, which was what I was thinking about in preparing for this talk, I think actually the impact of the presidential election may be as likely to have as great effect in terms of that president's appointments to federal agencies, particularly the FDA is one that stands out, where, as we've seen, the court looking more closely at, say, what the agency is doing and arguing with respect to preemption. I think that's one area where I think we could possibly see a potentially great impact coming out of the election that I think will, of course, then have an effect on the courts as well.
Seems to me both the outcome of the election and the possible retirement or leaving of the court of justices are both so speculative at this point that there's not a great deal that I can add to what my panelists have said. I'll just say this, that if I get the opportunity, I will contribute, maybe for an exercise machine for Justices Scalia and Thomas.
Well, with characteristic wit, Bill, you have given us an interesting thought. The collection will be taken up in the back. So. In any case, we will open this now to questions. Let me ask, Dean, how long do we have this room for, or how long are we? Till 2. Okay, great. Terrific. Again, if you'll just direct your question to one of the panelists to begin with, others may chip in with answers as well.
If the fairness doctrine were to be reinstituted by a future Federal Communications Commission, given what we know now, how likely would it be to withstand constitutional challenge?
Gosh, that's a very good question, because I do think that we have a Supreme Court that is susceptible to First Amendment claims in this area. And, I think that an important factor, and I think, frankly, it would be an important factor if the court were to reach the constitutional issue in the Fox case, is that, the television spectrum today is not what the television spectrum was in the 1960s, and that's by virtue of the ready availability of television over cable, satellite, and increasingly over the Internet. And so I think that there would be a concern about the danger of subjecting, say, some portion of the television industry, say, broadcast or some somewhat larger subset to this sort of regulation and not subjecting other portions of the industry to it. And it's very hard to sort of figure out how you draw lines. On the one hand, the broadcast industry has historically been subject to greater regulation by virtue of the ease of obtaining broadcasts. On the other hand, is there any sort of meaningful basis for distinguishing between broadcast and cable channels in an era in which a majority of American households now have some form of cable or satellite? So I think it would really depend on the sort of contours of the doctrine, but I think that the general trend, at least on this court, is toward a sort of skepticism of any form of content-related regulation.
Yes.
I was hoping I could ask Mr. Otis to comment on Arizona v. Johnson, which will be heard in December concerning the Fourth Amendment, and what, if any, effect that might have on the Terry doctrine.
I haven't read the cert petition. If you could describe the case, I might be able to.
The case involves a routine traffic stop in which the passenger of a car was patted down by the police officer and a gun was found. And the issue in the case is regarding the fact that that officer had reasonable articulable suspicion to believe that that individual had a gun, but not that a crime had been committed, will be committed, or was, being committed at the time. So the lower court reversed the conviction of the gentleman for possession of a gun and marijuana.
Well, without knowing anything more about the case and just as you have described it, I kind of like the government's chances in that, because the court has actually been quite protective and understanding of the risks that a police officer encounters when he stops someone on the street, or making a traffic stop. Every year, dozens, if not hundreds, of policemen are shot. In completely unexpected circumstances. You're a policeman. You walk up, to the car. You stop. Knock on the window. You get blown away right there and then. And the court does seem to understand this. Now, in the case as you describe it, you say that the policeman did have reason to believe that the person he patted down had a gun. That, it seems to me, by itself will win the case for the government, because you cannot require police to assume a risk like that in whenever to make a lawful stop.
Can I just add one
sure.
thing to that, Terry, please?
Yeah.
The Terry doctrine is also important beyond just the law enforcement situation on the street. The guidelines that the Attorney General announced recently, changing the guidelines for terrorism investigations, are really grounded in Terry principles, including in the notion that to a trained police officer or a trained agent or a trained intelligence officer, for that matter, things may appear quite differently to them than they do to the rest of us who are not so trained. So that a particular pattern of behavior may be sufficient to base an articulable suspicion of criminal activity on that pattern when that pattern would not be obvious to us all. So that whole notion, I think the court will be very protective of it, because it has application in a broader set of circumstances than just street law enforcement.
Further questions?
Yes.
Specifically with the Wyatt C. Levine case, I'm wondering, if Ms. Levine is to lose the case, is it likely that, because I've heard some people say this, that is it likely that there will be some legislation having to do specifically with the preemption and the FDA, you know, even if she loses? And then as for the Altria case, I was wondering about the effects that it would have on the multiple light cigarette cases that are going on around, being litigated around the country, and in particular in the D.C. Circuit.
Sure. To take your first question first, I mean, you hit on an important point, which is that in the preemption cases, right, to the extent that the court is dealing with an express statement by Congress or something that an agency has done, then Congress is certainly free to step in and affect that result legislatively. Interestingly enough, though, the trend has not been for Congress to do that. I mean, various theories for why that's so. I think securities law, you tend to see Congress stepping in more often to sort of overrule a decision that the Supreme Court has made. So although that's certainly a possibility, the track record thus far suggests it's sort of a hard row to hoe for Congress to do that. In terms of the Altria case and the potential spillover effects, the question that you raise, I think one thing it's important to bear in mind with preemption cases is that even though decisions can have great impact and ripple effects, ramifications, they can also be decided very, very narrowly and thus impact a relatively minor segment of cases. And so I think it's hard to know in any one particular case until you see how the court decides it, whether you're going to see a great impact in the case or whether it's going to be narrowly focused, say, on the statutory text and the particular preemption clause at issue. So I hope that answers your question.
More questions? Well, I have one, I guess. I'll reserve the right to ask this last question, and that is, from what you know of trends in the courts of appeals and elsewhere perhaps, what do you think the docket will look like once more cases are taken? What other important cases are there out there that the court might add, if anyone has a thought?
I think we're all probably in something of a state of shock that the court has so many cases already on its docket. You know, I don't know that there are any really huge cases in the pipeline, with the possible exception of the Northwest Austin case that I mentioned earlier. I do think that it'll be interesting to see whether the sort of modestly greater number of cases that the court has on its docket already portends a sort of broader trend in the size of the court's docket overall. In recent years, there has been a slow and steady decline in the number of cases that the court is hearing. There are some indications that members of the court might be willing to increase the size of the docket modestly. I think it has gotten down to about 70 cases a year. Some have suggested that the court might be willing to hear as many as 100 cases. I think that's probably somewhat optimistic from the point of view of us practitioners who'd like to see the court hearing as many cases as possible. So I think it'll just be interesting to see what happens in that regard. That's something that's very hard to measure over the course of simply 1 year or two, but, you know, we may very well see a change in the trend over the next 4 or 5 years.
I have two thoughts about that, Terry. One is that I fervently hope that nowhere in the court's future, in the immediate future, is a determination of a presidential election contest. And number two, and I strongly believe Justice Kennedy shares my view on that. And number two, I think maybe not in the immediate near future, but not too far off, there will be a number of cases where the court will be called upon to address further this issue of the detention of unlawful combatants. You know, we now have that firmly within the realm of habeas, apparently. The military commission's process doesn't seem to be working all that smoothly, I think would be a fair characterization. And I think it highly unlikely that some very fundamental questions about executive authority to detain individuals in connection with combating terror will wind up presenting themselves to the court.
In yesterday's order list, the court granted cert, I think, in 7 criminal law cases. That shows a greater interest than it has had in recent years in criminal law. With the exception of sentencing, the court over the last few years has had quite an interest in sentencing and has managed in Blakely, Booker, Gall, and Kimbrough to do the admirable task of returning us to luck of the draw sentencing from which we supposedly emerged in 1984 with the passage of the Sentencing Reform Act, which is now a dead letter. Whether the court will take it upon itself to render the rest of criminal law a dead letter is, I think, an open question. But if I were a member of the ACLU, I would be thinking about taking some of the language that I told you about that appears in Kennedy versus Louisiana and launching a wholesale attack on the death penalty on the theory that there might be 5 votes against it. Indeed, just about 3 years ago in his devastating concurrence in Kansas versus Marsh, Justice Scalia noted that the court was maybe just one vote away from severely disabling, if not entirely eliminating, the death penalty, and the time may have arrived. I would certainly be thinking about it if I were in their position.
Well, thank you. George has reassured me that there will be no, how would it be styled? I guess, who knows, Obama versus McCain. Pleased to know that we will not go through that. And I appreciate all the panelists' comments. Thank you. And thank you all for coming. And we will do this. I can't speak for the Federalist Society, but I assume you'll do it at the end of the term. There you go. So come back. Thank you.